It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, U.S. hiring numbers last month beat many economists' expectations. We'll find out why and what the latest numbers tell us about the state of the economic recovery. First, it's been just over a month since the death of legendary Black and Bahamian American actor Sidney Poitier. We wanted to talk about his significance along with other Black actors and directors who came before and after him, and about the ways that Blackness, race, and civil rights issues have been portrayed on film over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of the work of Sidney Poitier? Do you have a favorite movie role that you'd like to bring up? What do you remember from the first time you saw it? And what questions or thoughts do you have about how Hollywood has given or not given opportunities for Black actors and directors to work over the years? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Artel Great is the George and Judy Marcus Endowed Chair in African American Cinema Studies and Assistant Professor of Critical Studies at the San Francisco State University School of Cinema. Artel, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Let's start with the passing of Sidney Poitier. That's what started us thinking about bringing you back onto the show. Can you talk about his career and some of its highlights?
Sure. Absolutely. You know, I think it's interesting. Sidney Poitier, without a doubt, was the most important Black actor of the 1950s and 60s. I would say, in fact, he was probably the second most important actor of the entire 20th century after only Marlon Brando. He didn't just, you know, open doors. You know, Sidney Poitier blew the doors off the hinges, okay? He was literally, you know, before his arrival, you know, the roles that were created for Black actors were really, really limited. In fact, prior to the arrival of Sidney Poitier, Black actors were, you know, in Hollywood were really relegated to the margins, and it was pretty bad. I mean, I would say that, you know, if they were not excluded altogether, you had, you know, Black characters being portrayed by white actors, you know, wearing this kind of grotesque blackface makeup as a form of minstrelsy to, you know, really degrade Black people. Or if Black actors were actually hired, you know, prior to his arrival, they were really limited in terms of being confined to portraying really regressive and ultimately demeaning roles as like servants or characters who were enslaved on plantations. And these depictions over time were just so toxic. I mean, just very, very toxic. And I think they really worked to crystallize this kind of false image of what Black Americans were. And this encouraged in our society the treatment of Black people as less than full citizens. And I think that, you know, sadly, this still haunts us. These toxic images still haunt the social psychology of Hollywood and America at large. And from within that kind of racial system emerges Sidney Poitier, and he comes with this dignity. He emerges with this pride and this kind of regal essence that speaks to not only his kind of presence, but his power and his ability to transcend so many kind of racial issues in this country.
Here's a listen of to Poitier in the 1967 movie In the Heat of the Night. He's a detective here. He and a white police officer, Gillespie, are visiting a potential suspect, a Mr. Endicott.
Let me understand this. You two came here to question me?
Well, your attitudes, Mr. Endicott, your points of view are a matter of record. Some people, well, let us say the people who work for Mr. Colbert might reasonably regard you as the person least likely to mourn his passing. We were just trying to clarify some of the evidence. Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie? Yeah. You saw it.
I saw it.
What are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
In the heat of the night there with Sidney Poitier. Artel, can you talk about In the Heat of the Night? One of the, I think when people think back of memorable Sidney Poitier high-profile movies, one of the big ones.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this film was explosive and hugely important. So, you know, you have to understand, like, this is 1967 In the Heat of the Night comes out, and Poitier is delivering this kind of spectacular performance as Detective Virgil Tibbs, who is a homicide detective from Philly. You know, he's from Philadelphia, and he's traveling down to Mississippi to visit his mom, right? But when he arrives in this town, there's a murder that takes place, and, you know, Tibbs ends up helping this kind of local, inept police department kind of solve this crime. And so in the clip that you just played, it actually is Poitier's character questioning Mr. Endicott, who is this old kind of rich, racist white guy. And he literally, you can hear it in the clip, he slaps Tibbs in the face, mm-hmm. you know, for questioning, you know, him. Like, how dare you, you know, question a white man in Mississippi in 1967, right? And Tibbs immediately, you hear it in the clip, he slaps him right back. Now, this was amazing, like literally amazing. And it's critical because the Poitier kind of retaliation slap was not written into the script at all, right? That wasn't in the script. That was Poitier's idea. And the studio, they didn't want him to do that. You know, they did not want him to do it, but he was able, because he was such a big star at that time, he was able to leverage his star power. And he really insisted, like, no, my character is going to respond to this man accordingly. And so they had to permit him to, you know, respond in that way. And this occurs at a moment, you know, that is like the very beginning of the Black Power struggle. And we start to see this become this important symbolic moment, not just in Black film, but in cinema, you know, broadly speaking. And this scene becomes known, you know, as the slap heard around the world.
Talking to Artel Grade from the San Francisco State University School of Cinema, looking at, so far we've been talking about Sidney Poitier, looking at wider issues of the roles Black actors and directors had in the movie industry. You can join in with your thoughts, your memories, or questions at 800-642-1234. Artel, earlier you mentioned, before Sidney Poitier, not a wide variety of roles in Hollywood movies for Black actors. I know last time I talked to you, you want to make sure we don't forget that there was a lot of other cinema here in the United States, often made by Black directors featuring Black actors, that you hope we don't lose sight of.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. I mean, there's a 125-year history of filmmaking that exists of Black people really engaging in cinema as this kind of recuperative project, you know, as far back as, you know, the late 1890s, when cinema is first invented, you know, Black people are really at the forefront and the vanguard of innovating this medium and really pushing the boundaries forward. You know, there are directors, there are women, you know, who are working as entrepreneurs, who are helping, you know, develop distribution networks for cinema. And this is all happening before there's even a inkling of a foundation of a Hollywood studio, right? The first Black studio was created in 1910 by a man named William D. Foster in the city of Chicago, actually in the Midwest. It was called the Foster Photoplay Company. And this was the very first kind of successful Black film studio. And it was founded really 5 years before the first Hollywood studio was ever founded, which was Universal Pictures in 1915. So, you know, when you think about it, we talk about Sidney Poitier. Well, what we're talking about in terms of his ability to kind of, you know, move the needle. Well, I like to use a sports analogy and say, like, Sidney Poitier was like the Jackie Robinson, right, of Hollywood film. I mean, that's an interesting parallel because he was respected, but he was also a complicated figure who was a symbol in terms of both the Black community, but Poitier was also a symbol in terms of the white imagination, where his characters, you know, that he portrayed represented, you know, assimilation and the politics of integration, because all of this is happening, you know, during the Cold War period of America. So it's a very kind of complicated range of experiences that Black contributions in cinema really speak to. And Sidney Poitier is an element of that, but he is an element that is kind of really rooted in the mainstream apparatus of cinema itself and the characters that he was actually allowed to portray during the early part of his career marked this kind of very sanitized version, right, of a Black, you know, person in America, you know, this very sanitized white imagined image of Black American experience.
Talking to Artel, great African-American film historian from San Francisco State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how civil rights issues have been? What do you think about how civil rights issues have been portrayed in movies, big or small? Are there titles that come to mind for you? Do you see more roles for Black actors and directors out there? Do you think things like the Oscars need to pay more attention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Artel Great, Chair of African American Cinema Studies, Assistant Professor of Critical Studies at San Francisco State University's School of Cinema, talking about, so far, the legacy of Sidney Poitier and some of the history of the opportunities that Hollywood and independent films have and haven't given actors and directors of color. You could join in if you have thoughts at 800-642-1234 or questions, 800-642-1234. Artel, you suggested a clip to us from a 1973 film, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Before we give it a listen, can you set up what we're going to hear?
Sure. Well, this film is an independent film made in America, directed by Ivan Dixon, who is probably, you know, most well known for his role in the television series Hogan's Heroes. But the film is actually an adaptation of a protest novel by the writer Sam Greenlee. And in the film, the protagonist is a man named Dan Freeman, right? Free man, right? And he is this kind of seemingly passive Black character who manages to become the first Black person to work for the Central Intelligence Agency, right? And he works there for a number of years before he leaves the agency and returns home to the city of Chicago, where he uses his knowledge that he learned in the agency to help affect change in his community.
All right, here's a listen to a part of The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
Get your education, boy, she used to say. Because that's the only thing the white man can't take away from you. And she was right.
You know, I can't figure you, man.
What's the figure?
I mean, what are you in this for? You want power, you want revenge, you know? What is it?
Hey, it's simple, Willie. I just want to be free. How about you?
So do I.
And I hate white folks. Hate white folks. This is not about hate white folks. It's about love and freedom, enough to die or kill for it if necessary. Now you're gonna need more than hate to sustain you when this thing begins. Now if you feel that way, you're no good to us and you're no good to yourself.
Artel, I have not, I'll be honest, I haven't seen this movie. Make the case that we should go and find it and check it out.
Oh, it's not a surprise, Rob. Let me tell you, it's not a surprise that you haven't seen this film, right? This film was, in fact, actively ultimately banned in the United States, in the early part of the 1970s. The film manages to capture the tensions and the, real social turbulence that is taking place in the nation during that time, as like the tail end of the civil rights movement entering into the Black arts and the Black power movement. And it directly tackles, issues of class and race through these characters. And this one particular character, Dan Freeman, manages to infiltrate the Central Intelligence Agency, and he uses his knowledge, to awaken kind of critical Black consciousness in the city of Chicago, where he actually is able to mobilize, the street gangs and turn them into freedom fighters against oppression. So, this film is very powerful, and it was ultimately banned by the FBI, where they literally deployed agents to theaters and demanded that the film be removed. So the fact that you haven't seen the film is not surprising at all. It was actually actively repressed.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Susie is with us in Williams Bay. Susie, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that In the Heat of the Night is one of my favorite movies of all time. And another movie that comes to mind is Blazing Saddles. And just the fact that the Black sheriff was really poking fun at stupid racist white people in that movie.
Susie, thanks for the call. Not by a Black filmmaker, is a Mel Brooks movie. I believe he brought in Richard Pryor to help write for Cleavon Little as the star of Blazing Saddles, if I'm not mistaken. But some very frank talk about race in that one, Artel.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting film. And Richard Pryor was, a co-writer of the screenplay of that. And he actually was supposed to play the role of Cleavon Little, but he was so mercurial, during this period that the studio was like, no, we don't want to come near, him for that particular role. But, what's interesting from that caller in regards to Blazing Saddle is that film was a Western. And it made me think about, and a lot of people don't know this, but to tie it to Portier, as she mentioned her, kind of favorite film being In the Heat of the Night. Well, a lot of people don't know that Portier started to face a lot of criticism in his career toward the end of the 1960s, particularly from people who felt that, the roles that he was playing were really safe for the consumption of white audiences, where he was playing this likable kind of Black figure who was really sanitized. So as he started to take control of his own image, he decided he wanted to step behind the camera and actually start to direct. And he directs his first feature film in 1972. And that film is called Buck and the Preacher, and it stars Portier, Harry Belafonte, and Ruby Dee. And this is important because the first film he chooses to direct on his own is a Western, right? A Black Western. So of all the genres he could have made, why did he want to make a Western? Well, he wanted to make a Western because it's a deeply historicized genre, and he understood that the industry itself had historically, erased the contributions of Black people as cowboys in Western films, So this idea of what does a Western look like, or what does a cowboy look like in Hollywood? Well, they look like John Wayne. they don't look like Sidney Poitier. And that is because the Western genre is fundamentally tied to this idea of this quintessential American genre. Right. This is the genre that really kind of sets up frontier expansion and understands like how we came to be Americans. But, in the 19th century, like one out of every four cowboys was Black. Right. But in Hollywood, you don't see that represented. And so Portier chose to actually use his first film as a director to bring light to this hidden history. And it even, reminds me of the word cowboy itself, right? Which should be interrogated, I would say, because it actually originates from a pejorative term for Black ranch hands, right? Perpetuating this kind of racialized practice of calling Black men boys. So they were called cowboys as opposed to ranch hands, right? Or cattlemen, like their white counterparts were called.
I want to take a couple minutes, Artel. You are a director and an actor yourself. You have a film project called The Love Cycle, I understand currently in progress, addressing Black life and relationships. You study this a lot. What kind of things does that make you think about as you're acting and directing in your own work?
Wow. Well, I think about, you know, really honoring the nuances and rhythms, right, of Black life. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking deeply about how I can create work that embodies the full weight and complexity of what it means to be in a Black American, particularly given the kind of overall fascination with Black pain and suffering. You know, my work with the Love Cycle films is really about how do I recalibrate the national conversation around Black lives by focusing on love, you know, and joy, as opposed to, you know, pain and Black trauma, right? This is my kind of way of making an intervention and, you know, really reimagining the cultural politics of cinema in a way that's, you know, not only expanding the iconography of Black, you know, images, but pushing the boundaries of what Black film can be and what that can look like. And doing so in a way that, like I said, embodies the full weight and complexity and the nuance and the interior life of Black Americans. Because nuance and complexity are important. Black people are multi-layered individuals. You know, they are not one-dimensional. You know, they are not one-dimensional characters. And many people in Black communities are really yearning to see themselves in a multi-dimensional way on screen, in a way that's entertaining, but also political and poetic. And that's what I'm doing.
Artel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, Rob, appreciate you having me.
Artel Great is the George and Judy Marcus Endowed Chair in African American Cinema Studies, Assistant Professor of Critical Studies at the San Francisco State University School of Cinema. He talked to us about actor and director Sidney Poitier, who passed away last month, and how civil rights issues and the Black experience have been portrayed on film over the years. Coming up after the news, employers hired a lot of workers last month despite a surge in Omicron cases. We'll break down the latest numbers with a reporter who covers the economy. And you can join in. Have you seen an economic change in your life? Have you changed jobs yourself? Or are you one of the people on the sidelines, not going back into the workforce for one reason or another? We would love to hear from you. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a scientist who says a whopping 14% of the world's tree species have yet to be discovered. Now, the U.S. Department of Labor released its latest jobs numbers last week. They blew past what many economists were expecting. The U.S. added nearly 467,000 jobs in January, a figure that's seasonally adjusted. The jump in hiring happened despite surging Omicron cases last month that caused widespread disruptions for businesses and employees. We're taking a closer look at what the numbers tell us about the state of the economic recovery, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you recently started a new job? Have you recently left a job? Or both? Why was now the right time to make that decision, if so? If you're an employer or a business owner, has it been easier to hire workers, or are you still struggling to fill those open spots? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Janelle Marte covers the economy and the Federal Reserve for Reuters. Janelle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, better than expected is what people are saying about these numbers. First of all, why were expectations for a lower, maybe a gloomier job report last month?
Well, Rob, you already mentioned Omicron, and that was the big factor that was expected to at least put a damper on hiring. And some economists were expecting that we might even have a contraction in the labor market because of what we've been hearing from businesses that have had to cancel events, people having to stay home at times if their child's schools were temporarily closed or their daycare was closed. And the expectation was that this was going to at least slow down hiring. But instead, we saw, like you mentioned, very strong numbers. Businesses kept adding to their staff, and there were fewer layoffs than we typically see at this time of the year.
And it wasn't just January. The numbers for November and December, which had been a little ho-hum, they were revised upwards, so they look pretty good too. Now, these monthly reports, this is just one indicator. This isn't the whole story. But with those 3 months in mind, what does this say about the job market now?
I think it's showing that we had much steadier job growth over the course of the year last year than we initially thought. And that's just part of how this data works. You know, it's based on surveys, and over time and every year at this time of year, they do revisions with more information. And so what we learned is that the job growth over the course of last year was steadier than we initially anticipated. And this just supports the picture that the labor market is getting stronger and that we are seeing more people get back to work.
There's this other indicator called the labor force participation rate, which means basically, as I understand it, people of working age and the percentage of them that are actually working versus not working for whatever reason or not seeking employment. That's still a little bit lower than it was before the pandemic. It's been inching up. What are you watching for there?
Good point. So this is a metric that economists like to watch closely because it does show what share of the population is working or looking for work. And when we're looking at things like full employment, this concept that anyone who wants a job can get a job, if the labor force participation rate is not quite back to where it was before the pandemic or taking longer to come back, that could be an indication that people are either getting discouraged or for whatever reason, not able to get work or feel like they can't work right now. And so I think that's where people are starting to anticipate, well, okay, what is causing that participation rate to recover a little bit more slowly? And there are some economists that say that it's partly because of the pandemic. So I mentioned some of the challenges with childcare being less available in many parts of the country. And we're also seeing an increase in retirement, or rather an increase, or rather it's more of a decrease in people coming back to work from retirement because of the pandemic in part. And so people are watching this number to see the workers who have left the labor force, will they come back? And maybe can we really say we're near full employment, you know, until that happens? And it's part of the ongoing debate that's happening right now.
We are talking about the latest jobs numbers with Janelle Marte with Reuters. She covers the economy and the Federal Reserve there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Did you retire maybe earlier than planned? Are you thinking about coming back to work or not? Did you just get a job, just change jobs, just leave a job? And if you are someone who hires people, what are things like for you right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Janelle, I just asked people if they're part of what some people have called a great resignation or quitting. You use the phrase in one of your pieces, a great reshuffling, when you look at the labor market. What do you mean by that?
So the great resignation has come about because people are quitting their jobs at near record rates. So last year, an average of 4 million people quit their job every month. And that is staggering. We haven't, you know, this level of quits is not, like I said, it's near record rates. So what's happening, though, is that a lot of people are taking a moment. They're seeing what's going on with the economy. They're seeing that job openings are also near record rates. Last month we had, as of December, there were 10.9 million job openings. So for people who are working, who are able to work, that means that they have more options than they have in the past. So some of this is just related to what economists call cyclical, right? We're at a moment now where the labor market is growing, is improving, companies are hiring. And so for people who have a job or are thinking about doing something different, that presents them with more opportunities, more options, and workers are taking advantage of that. And so that's what we're seeing I called it a great reshuffling because it's more of people switching jobs. Hires are greater. The number of hires happening every month is greater than the number of people who are quitting. So that would suggest that most people who are quitting are doing so for another job. Hopefully you would think it's for a better job, right? You hear a lot of people talking about flexibility, work from home. They're taking the moment to say, okay, well, hey, there aren't that many people willing to step up right now, asking for more money. They're asking for better pay, bonuses. But it's not always people switching for a positive reason. You could imagine that there are also people who are quitting because they have to, because the circumstances related to the pandemic have changed. And so they're stepping away and then coming back when they're able to work again.
I've seen some people make a case that that's part of the story with job numbers not going down during the Omicron surge. Employers saying, yeah, maybe even with this surge, my business is going down right now, but I'm in this desperate competition to hire people. I can't stop hiring people. I'll bank them for the future. Do you think that's part of the story?
That is part of what's going on. So we have seen that businesses, so typically, you know, a lot of businesses will boost their hiring for the holiday season, and then they will let people go around January. What's going on is because of the staffing shortages that a lot of companies are facing, they're holding on to those workers a little bit longer and saying, hey, we got you in, it's going well, why, we're going to keep you as long as we can. And so that is also contributing to the stronger employment growth that we saw in January. Because of technical reasons, you know, the labor market numbers are adjusted. And so if we don't have as many layoffs as usual, then that can boost hiring.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Deb is with us in Appleton. Hi, Deb.
Hi, good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm recently retired myself, but I have friends who are approaching retirement age or who are at retirement age who were not planning on retiring as soon as they are, you know, this year, last year, next year, but are now planning to retire. And the biggest cause of the fact that they want to now retire early is because of the stress levels that their jobs are causing them. And that's directly related to COVID because of shortage in staffing, because of higher expectations from employers, because of some of those shortages, or because of extended hours that people are having to work. There's just been a lot of stress related to work issues. Mm. I'm from the education field myself, and teachers, for one, are stressed because they have kids online and they have kids in the classroom, and they have to make sure that kids are following the rules about all of the COVID protocols, and they have just so much more on their plates than they did. I mean, teachers have always had a lot on their plates, but even than they did, you know, 3 years ago.
Deb, thank you so much for sharing your story and that of your friends, Janelle. A lot of people just feeling more stress, maybe driving them out of a job or out of the workplace.
That's absolutely true. I've looked at this a little bit in, for instance, the childcare industry. So that's an industry where the work is typically low paid and very demanding. So as the caller mentioned, you can have situations where people are saying, hey, I'm not getting paid enough to put up with this stress. And as well, because of the fact that their colleagues might be quitting, then they have to put in longer hours. And it's making it difficult, especially at a time when there are other industries that are better able to increase pay. So you might say, hey, you know, I talked to some people who were seeing offers for jobs that they would consider to be less stressful, maybe not as rewarding if you're someone who's really passionate about that field, like in education, or passionate about childcare. But you could say, hey, I won't have to deal with as much responsibility and I'll be paid more. So what's going on is that some industries are facing increased competition from other industries that they typically are not used to competing with. And it's making it especially hard for them to fill their open positions. And it's toughest on the ones like, again, childcare is a good example where it's difficult to raise pay because of the way that it is, that pay is structured in that industry, meaning that it's based off of what the client, aka the parent, is willing or able to pay. And so, as we all know, childcare is already very expensive in this country. And so there's just this tension here of how can they adjust the structure of the program to make it so that it's, you know, more affordable, but also they can better retain the employees and the high qualified employees that they need. And that this is happening in a lot of in a lot of different industries to different extents.
Deb, thanks for the call. We're talking to Janelle Marte. She covers the economy and Federal Reserve for Reuters, with us today to talk about better than expected hiring numbers in January, plus December and November. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed jobs? Are you considering changing jobs? Have you left the workforce, or are you thinking about it? Or are you thinking about coming back into the workforce? Are you hiring people or trying to hire people? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at hiring in the United States and why the latest jobs numbers beat expectations. Janelle Marte with Reuters stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences in the job market as an employee or employer. 800-642 is the number. 800-642-1234. Need all those numbers in there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Janelle, I want to get into the other half of your beat. Now, the Federal Reserve, there's concern about inflation, of course, going on with these jobs numbers too. And some people have said, and I think you may have even mentioned something like this, Janelle, in your work, that hot, good-looking jobs numbers may free the Fed's hand to try to deal with inflation. Can you connect the dots?
So the Federal Reserve is has a dual mandate. And so that means that it has a responsibility or a mandate to not only promote job growth and aim for maximum employment, but also to keep prices steady. And so it's a two parts of its mandate that can sometimes face a little bit of tension in the sense of, well, we're in a moment right now where 2.9 million Americans are still out of work when compared to before the pandemic. But inflation is at the highest level that it's been in about four decades. So the Fed needs to control that, you know, keep in a focus on the second part of that mandate now, which is becoming more urgent. So what this jobs report does is it provides more evidence to suggest that the labor market is in a strong place. So the Fed can then continue with its plan, the plan that it's, you know, signaling to markets that it's putting into place of removing some of the support that it provided during the pandemic, right? So its officials have been saying for a few months now that the economy does not need the same kind of support. We're almost now with the 4% unemployment rate, we're approaching the unemployment level seen before the pandemic. And again, with inflation being so high, they definitely want to move toward removing that support to minimize the risk that they could fuel for further price increases and to perhaps even slow demand a little bit so that that can ease off of some of the pressure that is leading to those higher prices.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us on his way into Appleton. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
My question is that when I retired, we all had to wait till we were 65 to be able to have insurance on Social Security. But now, because other insurance was so expensive or even not available. Now with the Affordable Care Act, if I quit my $50,000 a year job at 60 and retire and maybe take a part-time, or maybe I've got some money in my IRA I can take out some of, I can get insurance on the Affordable Care Act. Do we have any data on whether that's a few thousand people or a few million people that are able to do that or are doing that now?
Tom, interesting. I haven't seen anything about that, Janelle. Have you run into that?
I think it's something that I would have to check the numbers on, but certainly you're bringing up a good point, which is that that flexibility to purchase insurance if you're able to get a more affordable plan is probably playing a role. You also have to think about, you know, you mentioned retirement savings. The unique thing, given though, I know we've had some weakness recently in the stock market, but if you think about it, there's been quite a run-up in the stock market during the pandemic. So that's another thing that might be helping people who are in retirement or near retirement age, is to say, okay, my portfolio is doing decently well. I can afford to step back from the labor market or can afford to stay in retirement versus coming back to work.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. The hope, the case numbers for Omicron seem to be going down pretty steadily. The hospitalization and death numbers, we hope, of course, will follow that. What kind of things are people watching for in the economy as, fingers crossed, Omicron doesn't loom so large?
So we'll be watching for, obviously, you mentioned case numbers. And, you know, there's a lot of high frequency data that economists watch now, and that can include mobility numbers, so that, like, that's taking cell phone data and seeing how, you know, are people moving around, leaving, traveling, doing things like that. We also have some, you know, unemployment claims that are looked at every week, consumer credit card spending data. These are just figures that we can keep an eye on to get a better sense of how the economy is reacting to the virus and to other shifts going on right now.
And I should ask, people are getting hired. People are apparently having the flexibility or willingness to change jobs. Is that reflected in wage numbers? Is this driving up wages on average for American workers?
Well, good point there. The wage growth is definitely a metric that's being kept kept an eye on. You have to consider, because of the high quits rate and the labor shortage, we're seeing wages go up, especially for those jobs in the low end. Think about retail, or in some cases restaurant jobs and things like that, where pay is coming up, and it's even coming up on the high end. I know we've had a few stories recently about some more, you could call tech jobs or professional jobs, where the pay is increasing. We're hearing a lot about that on Wall Street for sure. So definitely wages are coming up, and it's something to keep an eye on. And, you know, there are people wondering, well, how long will that continue? And if we start to see some of these restraints ease over time, will that then kind of cause workers to lose some of the leverage that they've gained? And we'll have to keep an eye on and see.
In just our last 30 seconds, Janelle, what do you have your eye on in particular?
Well, I am going to be watching for more information on how that recovery looks like by gender and race. So we've had some strong gains, but the Black unemployment rate is still much higher than the white unemployment rate, about two times as much. And we're seeing that Black women have had a slower, have more ground to cover. So I'm going to keep an eye on those things to see how the labor market heals from now on.
Janelle, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
That's Janelle Marte. She covers the economy and the Federal Reserve for Reuters. She was with us today to talk about why the January jobs report showed stronger hiring than previously expected. Still time for you to share your story. If you've switched jobs lately, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, have you seen a snowy owl this season? We'll check out the cool and unique birds, their visits to Wisconsin, why they vary from year to year, and find out how to get the best chance of getting a glimpse of them. And maybe you can report your own sightings along the way. That's Snowy Owls tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Valentine's Day is coming up. Are you looking for some Valentine's candy? Do you want to make sure you're getting the same things that everyone else is? If so, you're in luck. The website candystore.com is out with their annual state-by-state map of the most popular Valentine's Day candies based on their sales and other industry info. Here in Wisconsin, number three, Ghirardelli chocolate gift boxes. In second place, Hershey's Kisses. And number one, the Conversation Hearts. You know, those chalky candies with words on them. Looking at our neighbors, Illinois agrees with us on the Conversation Hearts. Iowa has M&Ms in the top spot. And Michigan and Minnesota are big Nirvana fans with a heart-shaped box of chocolates taking the top spot. Candy news you can use. This is Central Time.